you go. Well, I was worried about that CD for a second. I'm going, who are those guys? This is Rick Cogan. An abbreviated show tonight, abbreviated after hours because of the Hawks game and the Pope's game coverage. This is a great hour I'm going to spend with my great friend David Royko, who is the editor of a new book, a book that it's astonishing me, David, that your dad has been dead. Your dad was named Mike Royko, has been dead for more than 20 years, and a day doesn't go by that someone doesn't say, hey, you knew Royko? I wish Royko was still around. You must get... It's insane to me.
Karen was in... Karen, my wife, we're in Cleveland every other weekend because we have a son who lives in a group home there. And Karen was in the grocery store. I don't know if it was a Whole Foods or whatever it was in Cleveland. And she I think she was writing a check, actually. So we're old school. And the cashier, he wasn't a young guy, but he wasn't an old guy. And he said, oh, Royko, are you any relation? She said, well, yeah, he's my father-in-law in Cleveland.
Wow.
So, I mean,
he was syndicated in a lot of papers in the day. But I still think, part of it is the nature of newspapers have changed. And newspapers used to be a very, very important part of not everybody's, but the majority of people's lives. And your dad was generally the first thing, no matter what paper was in, whether it was Cleveland or Arizona or somewhere in California, and certainly in Chicago at the Daily News and then the Sun-Times and the Tribune, it's the first thing everybody turned to.
Yeah, I still see people saying how when he went from one from the Sun-Times to the Tribune, they secretly subscribed to the Tribune. They couldn't bear it.
They would steal it from the newsstand or the news boxes up there. David, we talked about this before, and again, I think this would be an ideal. David does not, sadly, make any money off the royalties of this thing because of the strange deal that was made. This was a labor of love for him to put together the book called The Best of Royko, The Tribune Years. What always surprises me, before we get into what you thought rereading all of these, is the fact that for many people, Mike was never a Tribune guy. I mean, he kind of went there kind of reluctantly when Rupert Murdoch bought the Sun-Times, but he spent a lot of years running for the Tribune.
He spent about half his career.
I know.
I mean, yeah, and I guess I had known that before, but when the Trib asked me to put this together, and then I looked, and that's when it really hit me. My God, this is half of his body of work.
Yeah.
And, and it took him a while to, the Daily News was where he felt like that was his home. That was really his home. Sun-Times, okay, he could deal with it. He didn't have to change offices.
Same building.
Yeah.
And, same people around you.
Yeah. But the Tribune, now that was a big culture shift for him. And that was just, it went against everything. And,
Well, I think partly because when your dad started in the late 50s and early 60s, the Tribune was this bastion of kind of very ultra-conservative kind of viewpoint, and still run by Robert R. McCormick, and was kind of the Republican house organ.
Yep. And the Daily News couldn't have been any more different.
No kidding.
And so for him to walk across the street, but it shows. And this was back before the general public knew who Rupert Murdoch was. He knew who Rupert Murdoch was.
Oh, of course.
And the whole thing about no self-respecting fish would be wrapped in a Murdoch paper.
Right,
and I think he brought Rupert Murdoch into the consciousness of a lot of people who never knew who this guy was.
Chicago.
Now, I mean, my God.
The alien, your dad
exactly
called him charmingly.
And that's what it took to get him over to the Tribune. But over time, he settled
sure.
in.
No question. You must have, though, in putting together the couple hundred, how many columns are in this book?
Well, it's funny because they first asked me to pick 250 columns, and I emailed back. I said, do you know how many columns that is? I mean, most of the books that have come out have maybe 100 columns.
Right.
And this is going to be a single volume. And so I think it came down to 179 or something like that.
Well, one of the great things about the book, and again, it's called The Best of Royko the Tribune Years, is one of the great things about your dad's many collections, of which there are probably about one, two, three, two from the two after he died, and two, three, four, maybe five, six, seven, maybe.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You can get almost every Royko column in book form these days. Is that you can flip anywhere in the book. The great thing about it is you can flip anywhere in the book and you'll find a column and you can read a column. And the astonishing thing about your dad, and I say this being a newspaper guy, and you can address it being a writer yourself, a very talented writer, it is the quality of writing. At one point, Mike was writing six columns a week. Then he went to five. Then he went to four, and he thought, you would have thought that he had been laid off from a job. I mean, he's going, Rick, what do you think? I'm going to write four a week. I go, Mike, that's more than almost anybody in this country is doing. Ann Landers did it, and some people who wrote horoscope columns did it, but that's not what your dad was doing. That durability had to be one of the things in reading all of this and putting this book together that really impressed you all over again.
Yeah, I mean, reading the book, I was always looking for something that would be, you know, relevant now or you know, and so there were some columns, you know, about Chicago stuff that really, you know, wouldn't, unless you knew the characters, wouldn't play. But those columns, though, themselves, they were always terrific. In fact, there were sometimes columns, it was frustrating that I couldn't use this one because it would have taken another 500 words to give the background. And I think in the last collection, the two career spanning collections, didn't you pull out paragraphs that was great because that took, I mean, these gems from columns that otherwise wouldn't have been able to.
Right. What I did, and there was a big thing at the Harold Washington Library in honor of the first book. And what I did is I made up these things because I always thought, what would Mike say about something?
Yes.
And it was sort of, what did Mike, what do you think of little dogs? And I read a paragraph. Mike, what do you think of love? Mike, what do you think? And it was all over the board. David and I, later in the show, are going to read, because it is Christmas time, as people tell me, a couple of arguably his most famous column is the Mary and Joe column.
When I wrote it, when you posted on Facebook that you were going to be doing this, and I put it on my page, one of the first comments was, are you going to read the Mary and Joe column?
Yeah. The other one, it's less known. I'm going to read the Mary and Joe column, and David's going to read the one that I think is actually even better, and we will explain why I think that and why David's going to read that one later in the show. So please stay tuned.
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring-ting-tingling, too. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Outside the snow is falling, friends are calling, yoo-hoo. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you.
That's my bow to the holidays. Christmas music played by the soon-to-be late of the station, Aubrey Mumpower, the world's greatest engineer, is retiring after something like, he's looking at me now, something like 322 years here. So it's close. I may be off by a year. I'm here with David Royko. We're talking not only about the best of Royko, the Tribune years, but about his father and two very, very moving columns. Your father, in many parts of the city, had a image as the ultimate tough guy with no sensitivity and no total hard guy. That was really not the case. That, he had that element to him. We all do, I think. Certainly anybody who played on the softball team with him had that kind of image. There was a soft heart inside there, wasn't there, David?
Well, there always was, and he could not have been, you know, the crankiness or the curmudgeonness or whatever it was that would come out. It was coming out for the right reasons. He could not have been as He couldn't have written the way he did if he didn't have the compassion, the soft heart. He felt such pain for other people, and that's what pissed him off.
Exactly. 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 And, you know, many of his columns, and especially in a book like The Best of Roike of the Tribune Years, the other thing that comes out, which not many people, except very careful readers of Mike, would have realized, is an incredible... You'd realize it if you got to sit in his office and smoke a cigarette with him and hear him talk about life in general. His sense of humor was an astonishment, I think.
Yeah, it was... It was so deep, and it's... It was part of his genius. That's all there is to it. It could run through... everything, and the thing is, he could, you know, the other day, I think it was the Sun Times, we ran the column on Harold Washington
right.
And it's one of the greatest opening lines that he ever wrote. So I said to my Uncle Chester, "Don't worry, Harold Washington does not want to marry your sister." And yeah, I mean, right there, he summed it up with a belly laugh, but an aha moment.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
like this huge moment in Chicago and, you know, society here. And so, he doesn't come out with some profound statement or what. He comes out with this incredibly funny, but incredibly deep joke.
No question.
I mean, that was...
Did you find him, when you and your brother Robbie growing up with him, one of the things about being Mike Royko is Mike Royko worked incredibly hard. Those were in the days when he was running six and then 5 a week. I mean, the sort of hands-on... So that wasn't real. My father was not a hands-on father. The kind of hands-on father that we know these days was not like it was then.
No, and it took me many, many years to really come to understand that. Because, you know, when we were... Yeah, and then in the middle of it, you know, when I was 10 or 11, he starts writing Boss. So on top of everything else, he's writing this classic book, like, you know, in his spare time, haha. You know, and there was no spare time. So, no, he was a workaholic, but it was only really well into adulthood that I came to understand what it meant. What it wasn't like you could achieve what he did just by being good.
Yeah.
You had to be driven. You had to be competitive. You had to be on 24/7. And he was a rock star, because you were talking before about newspapers, the primary role it held in people's lives.
Oh my
so
God.
If you were a top yeah. newspaper guy, you were a celebrity, and he was the top dog. And, you know, it was something in the whole relationship with a bar. Because
yeah.
the thing is, he grew up in a bar,
right,
literally
kid.
Tending bar from he was 12.
Sure.
So that was, I used to say, a second home, but a primary, first home. I mean, it was where, and so, and all his life, that was a place. I mean, later in life, he got away from it because
right.
he wanted to live for a while.
A different kind of lifestyle.
But
also, it was, I mean, in that era when there were thousands of neighborhood taverns in this town, it was not that much different than the guy working in the steel mill
mm-hmm.
who would go across the street, have a few drinks with his buddies, and go home.
Right.
The Billy Goat happened to be across the street from both papers, and it was in an era where there were buddies there. I mean, these were pressmen, and before the Saturday Night Live celebrity and the, you know, which led to the ancient Cubs celebrity. I mean, this was it was a natural kind of thing to do.
Yeah, yeah, and boy, how that has changed. That when you wrote that piece, Rick wrote a piece not long ago about the Billy Goat Tavern, and
yeah.
how, and I realized reading that piece that there is no longer a newspaper next to the. There used to be the Daily News and Sun Times and the Tribune
and the Chicago American
and the Chicago
Today.
Yeah,
four newspapers within easy stumbling distance of the Billy Goat.
Yeah.
And there were, when the presses were there, there were pressmen down there. It wasn't just, You know, rock star Mike Royko. It was like guys, you know, who made...
Worked at the paper.
The newspaper.
I mean,
and I think he felt very, very comfortable in that environment. And there's no question that Sam Cyanis was among the best friends he's ever had.
Absolutely. He was like a brother.
Yeah.
He was like
there is in the new party room at the Billy Goat, which is kind of, as much of the place is, a kind of shrine to Mike, as well it should be. There's a lovely, lovely inscription in one of his collections that he wrote to Sam. It's in a glass case.
Uh-huh.
You got to go down and see it. So in putting this thing together, what have you heard from people who have read the book?
Yeah, different things from different people. There are people who never read Dad because they weren't reading papers when Dad, you know, people who are 40 years old right now were, you know.
That's right, of course.
You're 20 years old when he died. I mean, it was.
There were also people who would not, even in this year, would not allow the Tribune in their home.
That's right.
That is no kidding.
But what I've heard over and over is how these columns seem like they were written yesterday.
Yeah. You know,
they are, and boy, the more things change, the more they stay the same. There are columns that really feel like he's addressing things that are going on today.
Yeah.
And addressing them, well, pretty much better than anybody else is addressing them.
Well, I mean, you know, you look back at some of his gun
writing. Oh, yeah.
And it is just... I think, Mike, if he'd been writing over the last 20 years, and I never assumed what Mike would ever write, but his anger would have gotten so much more intense because he was making these really valid arguments about gun control.
Yeah.
Very valid. And
it drove him nuts, too, how little change he ever saw come from anything, not anything, just anything that he wrote, but from the horrible, and he died before these, you know, what have come to be commonplace now.
I'm going to spend this whole rest of the show talking to David Royko. He and I are going to read a couple of sort of holiday-centric Mike Royko columns from the past. So please stay tuned. You're going to get some commercials here, and then you're going to get some news, and then it's going to be Royko and Kogan.
You better watch out. You better not cry.
That would be called a Christmas song. I'm playing some Christmas music during this abbreviated after-hours show. I'm Rick Kogan. I'm sitting here with my friend David Royko talking, and we're both talking about David's dad and my dear friend Mike Royko, and specifically about perhaps the best Christmas gift you could buy, a book titled The Best of Royko, The Tribune Years. Don't let that Tribune part put you off. It is a gathering of Mike's columns for more than 20-some years.
17 years
that he wrote for the Tribune. This was not one of them. I promised you that Dave and I would read a couple of Mike's holiday...
And by the way, 14 years. I just said
14,
that.
Yeah. it probably seemed like 20 to your dad.
Yeah.
Mike wrote a column. He said that he remembered a column writing and starting it in 1963 and didn't finish it for about... 4 years. It took him a long time. It was going to be a Christmas column, and each year he would take it out, he'd look at it, and throw it back in a drawer. In 1966, he finally decided to use it. He'd rewritten it about 10 times, and he still didn't like it. He never really liked it. But that column wound up being used in school plays, church plays, sermons. It was known as my Mary and Joe column. It became so popular that I think that he reran it every Christmas Eve for 25 years, and he said he still doesn't like the column. It was also ripped off by all manner of lesser columnists around the country. Here it is, ladies and gentlemen. Mary and Joe were flat broke when they got off the bus in Chicago. They didn't know anybody, and she was expecting a baby. They went to a cheap hotel, but the clerk jerked his thumb at the door when they couldn't show a day's rent in advance. They walked the streets until they saw a police station. The desk sergeant said they couldn't sleep in the cell, but he told them how to get to a welfare office. A man there said they couldn't get regular assistance because they hadn't been Illinois residents long enough. but he gave them the address of the emergency welfare office on the west side. It was a 2-mile walk up Madison Street. Someone gave them a card with a number on it, and they sat down on a bench, stared at the peeling green paint, and waited for their number to be called. 2 hours later, a caseworker motioned them forward, took out blank forms, and asked questions. Any relatives? Any means of getting money? Any assets? Joe said he owned a donkey. The caseworker told him not to get smart or he'd be thrown out. Joe said he was sorry. The caseworker finished the forms and said they were entitled to emergency CTA fare to County Hospital because of Mary's condition. And he told Joe to go to an Urban Progress Center for occupational guidance. Joe thanked him, and they took a bus to the hospital. A guard told them to wait on a bench. They waited 2 hours, and then Mary got pains, and they took her away. Someone told Joe to come back tomorrow. He went outside and asked a stranger on the street for directions to an Urban Progress Center. The stranger hit Joe on the head and took his overcoat. Joe was still lying there when a paddy wagon came along, so they pinched him for being drunk on the street. Mary had a baby boy during the night. She didn't know it, but 3 foreign-looking men in strange, colorful robes came to the hospital asking about her and the baby. A guard took them for hippies and called the police. They found odd spices on the men, so the narcotics detail took them downtown for further questioning. The next day, Mary awoke in a crowded ward. She asked for Joe. Instead, a representative of the Planned Parenthood Committee came by to give her a lecture on birth control. Next, a social worker came for her case history. She asked Mary who the father was. Mary answered, and the social worker ran for the nurse. The nurse questioned her, and Mary answered. The nurse stared at her and ran for a doctor. The doctor wrote postpartum delusion on her chart. An ambulance took Mary to the Cook County Mental Health Clinic the next morning, where a psychiatrist asked her questions and pursed his lips at the answers. A hearing was held, and a magistrate committed her to the Chicago State Hospital. Joe got out of the House of Corrections a couple days later and went to the county hospital for Mary. They told him she was at Chicago State and the baby had been placed in a foster home by the State Department of Children and Family Services. When Joe got to Chicago State, a doctor told him what Mary had said about the baby's birth. Joe said Mary was telling the truth. They put Joe in a ward at the other end of the hospital. Meanwhile, the 3 strangely dressed foreign-looking men were released after the narcotics detail could find no laws prohibiting the possession of myrrh, frankincense, and frankincense. They returned to the hospital and were taken for civil rights demonstrators. They were held in county jail on a $100,000 bond. By luck, Joe and Mary met on the hospital grounds. They decided to tell the doctors what they wanted to hear, and the next day they were declared sane and were released. When they applied for custody of Mary's baby, however, they were told it was necessary for them to first establish a proper residence, earn a proper income, and create a suitable environment. They applied at the Urban Progress Center for training under the Manpower Development Program. Joe said he was good at working with wood, so he was assigned to a computer data processing class. Mary said she'd gladly do domestic work. She was assigned to a course in key punch operating. Both got $20 a week stipends. Several months later, they finished the training. Joe got a job at a gas station, and Mary went to work as a waitress. They saved their money and hired a lawyer. Another custody hearing was held, and several days later, the baby was ordered returned to them. Reunited finally, they got back to their 2-room flat and met the landlord on the steps. He told them Urban Renewal had ordered the building torn down. The City Relocation Bureau would get them another place. They packed, dressed the baby, and hurried to the Greyhound bus station. Joe asked the ticket man when the next bus was leaving. "Where to?" the ticket man asked. "Anywhere," Joe said, "as long as it's right now." He gave Joe three tickets, and in 5 minutes they were on a bus headed for southern Illinois, the area known as Little Egypt. Just as the bus pulled out, the three strangely dressed men ran into the station, but they were too late. The bus was gone. So they started hiking down U.S. 66. But at last report, they were pinched on suspicion of being foreigners in illegal possession of gold. That is just, I hadn't read it in some time. That is just inventive. It's Chicago. It's it flabbergasted me, David.
Well, and also one of the things about Dad, every line. I hate to use these kind of analogies. It always sounds, hyperbole, but it's like he always reminded me of Mozart. You don't change a note. It's like every single line from first sentence to last is there for a reason, and everything is built upon everything else.
And it also tells you this whole, everybody has the notion that Mike sat down at a typewriter or a computer and just the stuff just popped out like this. He worked incredibly, like a craftsman, a real craftsman. It does not come easily. You, I have ever thought, are a talented writer yourself. You have an e-book now available. You can go to davidroiko.com. It is the Chronicles of Ben book, which tells I think, heart-wrenching but honest story about David and his wife Karen and their son Ben, who is autistic and who now lives in Cleveland and had to leave the home where his brother Jake also lived. It is... Check it out. It's an e-book, and it's a couple bucks, and you will find out what a terrific writer you are. I've always thought that, David. And your dad would be proud of this, because I followed the Chronicles of Ben ever since you wrote a Tribune magazine piece about having to make that separation. On a more joyful note, you are going to hear David Royko read what I have ever called the Christmas tree column, and he'll tell you why. We had the choice. I said, David, which one do you want to read, Mary and Joe or the Christmas tree column? He chose the Christmas tree column, and wherever his mom and dad are now, they'd be really, really proud, and we'll tell you why after a couple of commercials. Rick Hogan again here, ladies and gentlemen. Is David Royko reading what I think, arguably, Mike's most moving column? David, you chose this for a specific reason, right? Not just that I think it's great.
Yeah, no, this is one of my favorite columns too. And the thing is, what many people don't realize when they read this is that this is completely autobiographical. There are a couple of tiny tweaks, like when he refers to my mother as saying she's kind of pretty. That was basically an understatement. I don't think Slats could have said she was a knockout bombshell and had the column have the same impact.
Here it is, ladies and gentlemen.
The conversation at the bar got around to Christmas trees. Somebody had mentioned how much they cost today and what a pain in the neck it is to go out in the bitter cold and shop around for a good one. Nah, said Slats Grobnik, there's nothing to it. Not if you know what you're doing. What makes you an expert? I used to work in a tree lot when I was a young guy, said Slats. My uncle used to sell them in the vacant lot next to his tavern, and that's when I learned the secret. What secret? The secret of having the most beautiful tree you ever saw. That's easy. The secret is to go out with a pocket full of money and spend what it takes to buy the best tree. Slats shook his head. Uh-uh. Money's not the secret. So, tell us the secret. All right. It was a long time ago, maybe 30 years. I was in the lot, and it was the night before Christmas Eve, about a half hour before I was going to help close up. I hadn't seen a customer in 2 hours. I had maybe a couple dozen trees left, and most of them weren't much to look at. By the time you get that close to Christmas, they've been picked over pretty good. So I'm standing by the kerosene heater when this young couple comes in and starts looking at the trees. I don't know them by name, but I know they live down the street in the basement of one of the dumpiest three flats in the neighborhood. He's a skinny young guy with a big Adam's apple and a small chin, not much to look at. She's kind of pretty, but they're both wearing clothes that they look like they came out of the bottom bin at the Salvation Army store. It's cold as a witch's toes, but neither of them have got on gloves or heavy shoes, so it's easy to see that they're having a hard time with their paychecks. Well, they start lifting the trees up and looking at them and walking around them the way people do. They finally find one that was pretty decent, not a great tree, but it wasn't bad. And they ask me the price. It was about $8 or $9. They don't say anything, they just put it down. They keep looking. They must have looked at every tree in the lot. Like I said, there weren't many that were good, but every time I gave the price at a decent one, they shook their heads. Finally, they thanked me and walked away. But when they got out to the sidewalk, she says something and they stand there talking for a while. Then he shrugs and they come back. I figure they're going to take one of the good trees after all. But they go over to the one, the tree that had to be the most pathetic tree we had. It was a Scotch pine that was okay on one side, but the other side was missing about half the branches. They asked me how much that one was. I told them that they'd have a hard time making it look good no matter how much tinsel they put on it, but they could have it for a couple of bucks. Then they picked up another one that was damn near as pathetic. Same thing, full on one side but scraggly on the other. They asked how much for that one. I told them that it was a deuce, too. So then she whispers something to him, and he asks me if I'll take $3 for the two of them. Well, what am I going to do? Nobody's going to buy those trees anyway, so I told them they had a deal. But I tell them, what do you want with two trees? Spend a few dollars more and get yourself a nice tree. She just smiled and said they wanted to try something, so they gave me the $3, and he carried one of them, and she took the other. The next night, I happen to be walking past their building. I look down at their window, and I can see a tree. I couldn't see it all, but what there was looked good. The lights are on, so I figure, what the heck? I knock on the door. They open it, and I tell them I noticed the tree, and I was just curious. They let me in, and I almost fell over. There, in this tiny parlor, was the most beautiful tree I ever saw. It was so thick, it was almost like a bush. You couldn't see the trunk. They told me how they did it. They took the two trees and worked the trunks close together so they touched where the branches were thin. Then they tied the trunks together with wire. But when the branches overlapped and came together, it formed a tree so thick, you couldn't see the wire. It was like a tiny forest of its own. The two of them looked so happy with it that it made me feel good the rest of the week. And thinking of those two orphan trees, which would have been tossed out if they hadn't come along, made me feel good too. So, that's the secret. You take two trees that aren't perfect, that have flaws, that might even be homely, that maybe nobody else would want. But if you put them together just right, you can come up with something really beautiful. Like two people, I guess.
And that column does me in, David Brico. It just does me in. It is as beautiful a kind of... The fact that it appeared in a newspaper is kind of shocking to me at this point. But it is just... And for you, it just got to be such an emotional kind of... It's got to be, at the same time, a kind of emotional punch in the gut, but also a like hand through your hair, too. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, it brings to life. I mean, yeah, you see pictures and things about your folks when they were younger. This brings them to life.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know.
It's really something. I got to tell you, this has been a great hour. I always like spending time with you, and it's often, I've spent some, you know, a couple of Christmases with your dad, too. And he and I never dealt well with the holidays, but that's another matter for another time. David Royko, thank you. It is Rick. Always a treat, and happy holidays. Merry Christmas to you and Karen and Ben and Jake and everybody else.
Well, the pleasure is all mine, and thank you.
The book, again, Perfect Christmas Gift, The Best of Royko, The Tribune Years. If you buy this book and don't have any other collections, you undoubtedly, this will be like your gateway drug to all the previous collections, because mm-hmm. you can have them all. You can have them all, and it's a great idea to be a really wonderful thing to put under a Christmas tree, no matter what it looks like.